The Ark of Millions of Years, Chapter 18, The Lost Civilization of Atlantis. Atlantis was first colonized maybe as early as 70,000 years B.C. with the Nakals and modern man, who were first from the motherland Mu, having arrived in ships. The first historic mention of Atlantis was made by Plato, a distinguished Greek scholar, historian, and philosopher who lived 400 years before Christ. Plato wrote an account in the Timaeus about his uncle Critias, who told how his ancestor Solon, from 639 to 559 BC, a great statesman, had visited Egypt nearly two centuries earlier. Solon, being a historian, desired to know more about the ancient history of mankind and of Egypt, even before its establishment as a kingdom, as he realized that the Egyptians had a reputation of knowing far more ancient history than the Greeks. He wanted to preserve these records of antiquity for his fellow countrymen. In The Atlantis Blueprint, Wilson and Flemath state the following. Solon was told by an old Egyptian priest, and out in the ocean, beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which we now know as the Straits of Gibraltar, there was an island continent called Atlantis, as large as Libya and Asia combined. By Libya he meant all of North Africa, and by Asia he meant an area equivalent to the Middle East. The priest then made a baffling statement. From Atlantis, he explained, it was possible to reach other islands that formed part of Atlantis, and from them the whole opposite continent that surrounds what can truly be called the ocean. Wilson and Flemath further state in their book, the Greek Neoplatonist philosopher Procles had stated that Plato's student Crantor, who lived between the years 340 and 275 BC, had visited Egypt, where he saw pillars inscribed with the legend of Atlantis. Plato wrote in another account called The Critias of how Atlantis was founded by the sea god Poseidon, or Neptune, who married a mortal woman and fathered five sets of twins. Poseidon gave the island its name of Atlantis, and also named the surrounding sea the Atlantic Ocean. His account states, the god built her a home on a hill and surrounded it with concentric rings of sea and land. The twins were each allotted a portion of the island, and over the generations extended their conquests to other islands and to the mainland of Europe. Great engineers, the Atlanteans built a circular city 11 miles in diameter, with a metal wall and a huge canal connecting it to the sea. Behind the city there was a plain 229 by 343 miles wide, on which farmers grew the city's food supply. Behind this were mountains with fertile meadows and every kind of livestock, including elephants. The Critias has many pages describing the lifestyle of the Atlanteans and their social structure. It speaks of magnificent buildings, temples, and palaces constructed of many colored stones, of hot and cold fountains, indoor plumbing, communal baths, and dining halls. They built numerous canals and covered bridges. Temples were covered with gold and silver, both inside and out. Roofs inside of temples were ivory, and the statues were of gold. One temple contained a colossal figure of Poseidon standing in a chariot, drawn by six winged horses, of such size that his head touched the roof of the building. On the outside of the temple were 10 statues of gold that represented the 10 kings and their wives. Plato describes the harbors of Atlantis as being filled with ships and vessels from all parts of the world, engaging in trade and commerce. The royal docks were lined with shops and naval stores. They wanted for nothing. The Atlanteans, especially the Poseidonians, studied the creative energies of the universe and penetrated the essence of nature's storehouse. The vibrations of plants, jewels, and metals, the latter including their vibratory effect on the psychic and intuitive nature of man. Their technology was highly advanced, calculating the meaning of numbers, the stars, and the elements. From the narrative, we learn that the island was divided into 10 parts, each part ruled by a king, and each part had a capital city, a sort of United States of Atlantis. All matters pertaining to government were deliberated until agreement was reached. Solon was told by the old priest that his knowledge came from the sacred Egyptian registers that were then 8,000 years old, or approximately 8,600 years B.C. of Plato's time. A written account in verse was made by Solon and handed down to Plato, who preserved it in the form of a dialogue for posterity. Unfortunately, he started the dialogue late in life and left the story unfinished. Plato further states in his narrative that the old priests of Sais told Solon the following: "Now, in the island of Atlantis, there was a great and wonderful empire which had rule over the whole land and several others, as well as over parts of the continent. And beside these, they subjected parts of Libya within the columns of Hercules, as far as Egypt, and of Europe as far as Tyrrhenia." According to Roman and Greek philosophy, Poseidon, or Neptune, as he was known by the Romans, was one of the Olympian gods. He was the son of the Titan god Cronus and the Titanid Rhea. The Olympian god Zeus, Jupiter to the Romans, was his brother. The Titans, also known as the Elder Gods, were an ancient race of gods in Greek mythology, which ruled the earth before the younger Olympian gods overthrew them. In Greek and Roman philosophy, they reigned for untold ages as supreme rulers in the universe and were of enormous size, possessed superintelligence, and were endowed with incredible strength. When they came to Earth, this planet was divided up between them, each Titan ruling a certain portion. The ruler of the Titans was Cronus, Saturn to the Romans, who was defeated and dethroned by his son Zeus. The Titans were the children of Uranus, heaven, and Gaia, earth. Uranus feared his giant children and chained them down in Tartarus, which was far under the earth. After Zeus, having defeated his father Cronus, he ascended to the throne. Cronus fled to Italy and brought in the Golden Age, a time of peace, happiness, and plenty, which lasted as long as he reigned. Does this not sound familiar? Could the Greek and Roman gods of mythology have actually been historical figures? Remember, legends state that the elder gods had 6 fingers and 6 toes, and were the builders of Tiahuanaco in Bolivia. These were the Nephilim. The Titans were a race of elder gods, which race had been previously identified as Nephilim. Thereby, the Titans were the fallen sons of heaven. Uranus, or God, and the Olympians were their giant offspring. The Greeks also refer to these elder gods as Els, and Elanakim, short for Elder Race, or simply the Giants. Many statues of these gods and goddesses were depicted as having wings of angels, some colossal in size. The Book of Giants of the Dead Sea Scrolls states that the Nephilim were giants and even had wings. These facts alone indicate to us that the Greeks knew these gods were Nephilim, and that indeed their incredible myths and fables were based on real historical figures and actual events. Men accepted these beings unconditionally as their gods because they had lost all knowledge of their true maker. As far as they were concerned, their gods were their creators. Note, in the depiction of an elder god below, the six fingers on each hand, which was a defining trait of the elder gods, or Nephilim. Titanides. Here is the first mention of female fallen angels, who were called goddesses. In the Doctrine and Covenants, section 29, it states, "And it came to pass that Adam, being tempted of the devil, for behold, the devil was before Adam, for he rebelled against me, saying, Give me thine honor, which is my power, and also a third part of the hosts of heaven, turned he away from me because of their agency." Many sacred scriptures and ancient writings say that there was a great war in heaven. We interpret this to mean in the highest spiritual universe, and that one-third of the host of this spiritual universe fell, or were driven out to the temporal universe. Whether or not the other spiritual universes were involved in this conflict is not clear, but the Gnostic writings indicate that they were affected and may have participated. One-third is a huge number. It could number in the tens of billions or more. Because of their vast numbers, is it not logical to conclude that not all of them came to planet Earth? Common sense would also dictate that they were not all male entities. Chief of the tribe, Tatunkanara, described that the Chronicle of Akakor is a history of the oldest people in the world. He explains that for a long time the tribe existed in a highly primitive state until the gods came and brought them light. On Earth, these beings ruled from Akakor, erected around 14,000 years ago. The chief went on to say that their home planet, called Shwerta, lay in the depths of the universe, a mighty empire consisting of many planets as numerous as particles of dust in the street. As previously discussed, the builders of Akakor and Tiahuanaco were elder gods or Nephilim. Could planet Earth have been a mere outpost? Maybe in the beginning, it appears that they were looking for the planet that the Redeemer might or could one day be born into. This wasn't made known until several thousand years later, when the spirit Earth united with this particular planet, and Noah, a descendant of Adam, made his appearance. Until then, perhaps they were colonizing all possible planets onto which the descendant of Adam, Noah, would come. In theory, corrupting the seed of all these planets would stop the birth of the Redeemer, because they knew his mission, if accomplished, would redeem all fallen planets in their possession. John 3:16 somehow became twisted in translation, because in the original Greek, the word for world is the Greek word cosmos. The Greek word cosmos refers to anything and everything that is in this universe. Therefore, the entire universe would be redeemed. If this world were the only fallen planet, it wouldn't have been necessary to redeem the entire universe. They erred by looking for an existing race not knowing that the seed of Adam would literally be transported to some planet in this universe. By some accounts, the Titan god Prometheus and his Titan brother Epimetheus were delegated by Zeus to create man. At least that is what they probably told man when he inquired as to who was his creator. Most of the Greek and Roman stories indicate that men were treated well by these gods, but at the same time, they were at their mercy. They usurped the original commandment given to man, subdue the earth, with one of their own design, subdue one another. What better way to hold man in willful submission than to tell him that they were his creators and gods? No self-respecting Nephilim in his right mind would have told man that they had been kicked out of heaven by God, and that his leader was Lucifer, whose mission was to corrupt their seed and take over planet Earth. It does appear that the Nephilim on the temporal creation were much less vicious than those from Enoch's account on the spiritual creation. Why? Maybe it is because Adam and his descendants down to Noah on the spiritual creation were very intelligent beings, having much knowledge of the workings of God and of the creation, and they were much more difficult to corrupt. On the other hand, men on the temporal creation, although intelligent, were uneducated, simpler, possessed trusting, childlike qualities that made them easy marks for corruption by these impressive supernatural beings. Plato's description of the Atlanteans is one of a nation united in peaceful endeavors, caring for one another, prizing intelligence and knowledge above material assets. Atlantis, in some ways, was a utopia, but one only has to read some of the stories preserved in myth about the activities of the Titans and Olympians, which has filled books, to realize that they were also warlike and notoriously promiscuous with mortal women and animals. Some of their unions with animals produced monsters. The centaurs were half human and half horse. The fabled minotaur was half human and half bull. The demigod Pan had the legs, ears, and horns of a goat. Satyrs were demigods with the tail and ears of a horse and body of a man. Gorgons were snaky-haired women like Medusa, whose frightful appearance turned the beholder to stone. Sphinx had the head of a man and the body of a lion. There were bird men, men with the head of various kinds of birds, namely falcons and ibis. The Chimera was a monster composed of the head of a lion, the body of a goat, and a serpent for a tail. Griffins had the body, tail, and hind legs of a lion, and the head, four legs, and wings of an eagle. Some of these creatures had the status of gods and demigods, being the offspring of the Nephilim. The Book of Jasher gives an account of Anna, son of Zibeon, who was the son of Zer, the Horite, who found the Yemim, in the wilderness when he fed the asses of Zibeon, his father. The land of Zer is the dukedom where Esau lived and where his children were born. The account of the Yemim reads as follows: "And whilst he was feeding his father's asses, he led them to the wilderness at different times to feed them. And there was a day that he brought them to one of the deserts of the seashore, opposite the wilderness of the people. And whilst he was feeding them, behold, a very heavy storm came from the other side of the sea and rested upon the asses that were feeding there, and they all stood still. And afterward about 120 great and terrible animals came out from the wilderness at the other side of the sea, and they all came to the place where the asses were, and they placed themselves there. And those animals, from their middle downward, were in the shape of children of men, and from their middle upward had some the likeness of bears, and some the likeness of kephas, with tails behind them from between their shoulders, reaching down to the earth like the tails of the Duchipath. And these animals came and mounted and rode upon these asses and led them away. And they all went away unto this day. And one of these animals approached Anna and smote him with his tail, and then fled from that place. And when he saw this work, he was exceedingly afraid for his life, and he fled and escaped to the city. And he related to his sons and his brothers all that had happened to him. And many men went to seek the asses, but could not find them. And Anna and his brothers went no more to that place from that day following, for they were greatly afraid for their lives. The practice of bestiality with mortal men will produce nothing as offspring, but this same practice with spiritual beings and mortal animals did produce monsters. The mating of the Nephilim with mortal women produced giant offspring. Subsequent generations over many thousands of years became, as the Critias states, diluted with too much of the mortal admixture, and the godlike element or divine portion of the Atlanteans began to fade away. Human nature many times took control and got the upper hand, making these generations appear base and degenerate. For example, about 35,000 years ago, Cro-Magnon man suddenly invades the western shores of Europe and North Africa. Professor J. L. Myers, from 1923 to 1939, describes Cro-Magnon culture as a well-marked regional culture of the Atlantic coastal plain. This term, Atlantic and Paleo-Atlantic, are often used when referring to Cro-Magnon culture. Colonies of Cro-Magnons are always clustered in the west, with the number of colony sites diminishing towards the east. To the west, there is nothing today but empty ocean. Where from the west did they come? It is a mystery that continues to plague anthropologists. The clue to their origin is their size. Cro-Magnon man was much larger than today's modern man, but was fully modern in appearance. His average height was 6 feet 6 inches, with many much taller. He was bigger and stronger than today's men. Even his brain size, which averaged from 1,600 to 1,750 cubic centimeters, exceeds that of men today. He was very intelligent. We would classify them in our times as giants. Giants that probably were degenerate descendants of the giant offspring of the Nephilim. Degenerate in the respect that subsequent generations became smaller and smaller. When the DNA of recovered biology is tested, it becomes evident that modern man could not have descended from Cro-Magnon man. It is genetically impossible. They were mortal, but their size and strength was a throwback to their now faded divine portion. In their day, Atlantis was located westward in the Atlantic Ocean. Atlantis had many colonies of peoples in the world that was regularly serviced by seafaring routes. These seafaring routes were established by the use of maps or charters. An ancient map has been discovered that shows the Antarctic without ice during the Golden Age. Hapgood, author of Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, discovered a map in the Library of Congress made by Orontius Phineus in 1531, showing Antarctica much as it does today, without ice. Obviously, this map was not the original, but could be a copy passed down from the Golden Age times. Hapgood uncovered another map showing Siberia and Alaska joined with no Bering Strait. A land bridge once joined the two countries more than 12,000 years ago. Historians have not accepted the idea that the world had been mapped prior to 10,000 BC, so Hapgood has been largely ignored. The giant descendants of the Olympians simply were some of the Atlantean colonizers of Western Europe. and the African coastal plains. They brought their advanced tool industries and technology with them from Atlantis. There is no evidence of a gestation period for tool development in their colony sites. Advanced tools and their extensive use appeared suddenly in the archaeology without the presence of any precursors whatsoever. In other words, there were no prototypes or simpler tools that developed into more advanced tools. About 16,000 years ago, another similar race colonized the continent, and about 10,000 years ago, a third race, known as the Azilians, invaded the same continent, all originally from Atlantis. Atlantis had several destructive periods. A portion of it sank about 26,000 years BC, the same time that one of the three island groups sank in Mu. This was probably due to worldwide tectonic plate activity that increased volcanic eruptions and earthquake disturbances of cataclysmic proportions. With a decrease in land size, it became necessary to colonize other areas for population control. Every few thousand years, Atlantis underwent serious upheavals and became geologically unstable, forcing hordes of refugees onto the Atlantic islands and western coasts of the continents. Each invasion was more advanced than the last, happening over a period of just under 25,000 years, namely the Aurignacian, Solutrean, Magdalenian, and Azilian cultures. The Azilian culture appeared just before the final destruction of Atlantis, and since the submerging of that land, there have been no more Cro-Magnon invasions, because Atlantis was the apparent source of the invasions. Now, all gone. An anthropological fact, usually ignored in some factions, is that there are notable differences in types of Paleolithic man. The term Cro-Magnon and modern man are used as if they were synonymous, but in a strict sense, they are not. All Cro-Magnons are modern, but all moderns are not Cro-Magnon. The Cro-Magnon culture disappeared after the 9500 BC cataclysm. The moderns survived. Thus, the sudden decrease of the cranial capacity to the average of about 1450 cubic centimeters is seen after the cataclysm. If nothing else, the authors wished to dispel the notion that the Cro-Magnon cultures were a primitive and boatless society. They were intelligent descendants of a highly civilized society who became pioneer colonizers on the Western European and African continents, having arrived in ships. A number of Cro-Magnon village sites show evidence of agriculture dating back as far as 15,000 BC. They lived in constructed houses and had all manner of advanced tools, needles, obsidian knife razors, musical instruments, even bone calendars whose symbolic notations border on writing. His caricature artwork has shown man wearing shoes, woven fabric pants, coats, hats, and clean-shaven. They were not shaggy-haired savages wearing animal skins. They even domesticated several species of animals, which may have included the horse, although the god Poseidon is credited with taming the horse. With each period of colonizing invasions came new innovations in technology carried from Atlantis. According to Churchward, the Nagas, the Nakals, left Mu, came to Burma, and then entered, colonized, and founded the Rama Empire, or what is now known as India, Burma, and Iran. Rama was the emperor of the Rama Empire. He acted as a figurehead for their deity, whose symbol, like that of Mu, was the sun. The capital city of Rama was anciently known as Deccan, but today called Nagpur. In the Rama Empire were seven capitals, which became known as the Rishi cities. The name Rishi in Sanskrit means master or great teacher. Atlantis and the Rama Empire had much in common, as both were colonies of Mu. Both developed advanced civilizations with high technology, higher than the civilization of Mu, and both had airships. The Atlanteans called their airships Valixi, and in the Indian epics, the airships of Rama are identified as Vimanas. The Atlanteans applied their technology toward military applications, while the Rama Empire always used their advancements toward peaceful endeavors. They also used flying craft in their engineering to lift large structures and stone into place. Vedic texts indicate there existed three types of aircraft: one for personal transportation, one for lifting and transporting heavy loads, and one for battle. Besides having airships, the Atlanteans developed weapons of mass destruction. They had mastered the use of crystals and the power of the sun. In addition to being able to supply power, light, and communication, they were capable of extremely powerful destruction. Subtly used, they could be adapted as a means of coercion, torture, and punishment. One weapon was described as a fireball, or Kapila's glance, that could reduce a whole city and its inhabitants to ashes in seconds. Another weapon is described as flying spears, missiles, that could ruin entire cities full of forts. The agenda of the Atlanteans was to rule the world by subjugating its colonies and other colonial empires of Mu. At the height of both civilizations, war broke out between them. According to the Lemurian Fellowship lessons, the Atlanteans invaded the Rama Empire with a well-outfitted army. Equipped with various types of formidable weapons, one Atlantean leader landed their Valixi, backed up by the invading army, outside one of the Rishi cities, and sent a message to the Rama priest king to surrender or be destroyed. The priest king answered, "We of India have no quarrel with you of Atlantis. We ask only that we be permitted to follow our own way of life." The Atlanteans perceived their reply to be one of weakness, as they knew that the Rama Empire lacked weapons of mass destruction. The Atlantean general sent another message back to the Rama priest king. "We shall not destroy your land with the mighty weapons at our command, provided you pay sufficient tribute and accept the rulership of Atlantis." Trying to prevent war, the priest king humbly replied, "We of India do not believe in war and strife, peace being our ideal. Neither would we destroy you or your soldiers, who but follow orders. However, if you persist in your determination to attack us without cause and merely for the purpose of conquest, you will leave us no recourse but to destroy you and all of your leaders. Depart and leave us in peace." Confident that the Indians lacked the military power to stop them, the Atlantean army began marching at dawn on the Rishi city. As the army approached, the priest king raised his arms toward heaven and applied a sort of mental telepathy known only to certain yogis in the Himalayas today. aimed toward the general and officers of the Atlantean army, in descending order of rank, that caused them to instantly fall dead in their tracks. Seeing the power of the priest king, the army panicked, turned tail and fled to their waiting airships and retreated back to Atlantis. Humiliated by their defeat, the Atlanteans decided to annihilate the major Rishi cities and take the empire by force using weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't until the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan that Sanskrit scholars could fully understand what was described in the Indian epics. The following are actual verses taken from the Indian epics. Gurkha, flying a swift and powerful Vimana, hurled a single projectile, charged with all the power of the universe. An incandescent column of smoke and flame as bright as 10,000 suns rose with all its splendor. It was an unknown weapon, an iron thunderbolt, a gigantic messenger of death, which reduced to ashes the entire race of the Vrishnis and the Andakas. The corpses were so burned as to be unrecognizable. Hair and nails fell out, pottery broke without cause, and the birds turned white. After a few hours, all foodstuffs were infected. To escape from this fire, the soldiers threw themselves in streams to wash themselves and their equipment. It was a weapon so powerful that it could destroy the earth in an instant. A great soaring sound and smoke and flames, and on it sits death. Dense arrows of flames, like a great shower, issued forth upon creation, encompassing the enemy. A thick gloom swiftly settled upon the Pandava hosts. All points of the compass were lost in darkness. Fierce winds began to blow. Clouds roared upward, showering dust and gravel. Birds croaked madly. The very elements seemed disturbed. The sun seemed to waver in the heavens. The earth shook, scorched by the terrible, violent heat of this weapon. Elephants burst into flame and ran to and fro in a frenzy over a vast area. Other animals crumpled to the ground and died. From all points of the compass, the arrows of flame rained continuously and fiercely. In the 1950s, when archaeologists were excavating the cities of Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, they discovered many skeletons of people lying in the streets, some holding hands, lying just as they had fallen from some horrible instantaneous event that annihilated them. David Hatcher Childress states in his book, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis, the following. These skeletons are among the most radioactive ever found, on a par with those at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. At another site in India, Soviet scholars found a skeleton with a radioactivity level in excess of 50 times that which is normal. Other cities have been found in northern India that indicate explosions of great magnitude. A city was found between the Ganges and the mountains of Raj Mahal, which seems to have been subjugated to intense heat. Huge masses of walls and the foundations of an entire ancient city were found fused together, literally vitrified. The following is taken from Childress's book. Dr. Oppenheimer, the father of the H-bomb, was also a Sanskrit scholar. Once, when speaking of the first atomic test, he quoted the Mahabharata, saying, "I have unleashed the power of the universe. Now I have become the destroyer of worlds." Asked at an interview at Rochester University 7 years after the Alamogordo nuclear test whether that was the first atomic bomb to ever be detonated, his reply was, "Well, yes," and then added quickly, "in modern history." A test of a weapon that resulted in similar effects was conducted above ground on an atoll in the South Pacific after World War II. The occupants of the atolls in the area were evacuated. The bomb was set up in the center of the landmass. Into the beach, the Navy drove a great post onto which they affixed a massive steel cable, which stretched 5 miles into the sea. At regular intervals on the cable, a barge was tethered and populated with live pigs. The physiology of pigs is similar to humans. The Navy anchored several miles away, just in sight of the trees of the atoll. When the bomb was detonated, witnesses on the vessel reported they could hear an ear-piercing scream as thousands of pigs perished in the stream of high-energy neutrons, killing them. Close to ground zero, they perished instantly. Further out, they died slowly and painfully. Much was learned about how nuclear radiation kills in inverse proportion to the distance from the nuclear event. About 14,000 BC, Atlantis attempted to subjugate a civilization in the area of the Gobi Desert called the Uther Empire. They developed a technology by harnessing the life force with the use of giant crystals called firestones to create scalar wave weaponry, which was fired through the center of the earth to annihilate their adversaries. In doing so, by the misuse of this power, they nearly did themselves in, which misuse caused a second part of their island continent to sink into the depths of the ocean, taking many lives with it. This second cataclysm, resulting in a mass exodus or invasion of people onto the continent, spoken of earlier in this chapter. Another name for the firestone commonly used by the Atlanteans was the term Tuwayoi stone. To describe their power source, the stone was in the form of a six-sided figure and set as a crystal. The clairvoyant Edgar Cayce, in reading number 2072-10, July 22, 1940, states, "In the beginning, it, the Tuwayu stone, was the source from which there was the spiritual and mental contact." It would seem that this is a reference to the seer stones that the Nephilim possessed. The Israelites possessed similar stones, referred to in Exodus chapter 28 as the Urim and Thummim. Could it be that the Urim and Thummim and the Tuwayoi stone are one and the same? Perhaps there are several sets of these stones. If one could locate a Urim and Thummim and apply the life force energy, electromagnetism, to either of them, would the energy activate these stones into becoming a power station such as was used by the Atlanteans? The power source was also used for medical treatment for the rejuvenation of bodies through the application of the rays from the stone. Atlantis had several of these power stations that were unintentionally tuned too high, which misuse caused the second destruction of the land. The Nakhals from Mu sent colonizers to what is known today as North Africa and the Mediterranean basis, or Egypt. This was the Osiris civilization. Ra was the first ruler of ancient Egypt, whose symbol was the golden-winged sun disk. Like the Empire of the Sun and the Rama Empire, Egypt worshipped a solar deity. After making an extensive study of all available writings and texts on the Empire of the Sun, the Atlantis civilization, the Osiris civilization, and the Rama Empire, it is the opinion of the authors from the evidence found that the emperors Ramu, Rama, and Ra were great rulers of these empires. They appear to have been immortal and divine beings, but nevertheless appear to be fallen sons, elder gods, or Nephilim of the Supreme God. The Hindus, however, share a different view. Besides being a great warrior and emperor, Rama, in Hinduism, was an incarnation of Vishnu, the Preserver, one of the Trinity of Supreme Gods. Most Hindus in India believe Rama to be an actual historical figure. His exploits and adventures in the Ramayana have made him a sort of national hero in India. In the words of Murli Manohar Joshi, Rama is not a Hindu god, but a national hero, and every Indian, irrespective of his religion, must accept that. Joshi made this statement in an article which ran in Time magazine, November 12, 1990, when militant Hindus were marching on a town to reclaim a site that they believed to be Rama's birthplace, now occupied by a dilapidated Muslim mosque. The Hindus had hopes of building a new shrine to Rama on the old mosque site. Joshi was a supporter of this movement. Another known colony was in Lhasa, Tibet. These were centers of learning where maps, charters, and records of the history of the world and mankind were stored in repositories and libraries for safekeeping. David Hatcher Childress's book, Vimana Aircraft of Ancient India and Atlantis, makes for fascinating reading. He writes the following: the Ramayana describe a Vimana as a double-necked, circular, cylindrical aircraft with portholes and a dome. It flew with the speed of the wind and gave forth a melodious sound. The ancient Indians themselves wrote entire flight manuals on the controls of various types of Vimanas, of which there were basically four: the Shakuna Vimana, the Sundara Vimana, the Rukma Vimana, and the Tripura Vimana. He goes on to say that the Tripura Vimana was powered by motive power generated by solar rays and had an elongated form, similar to a modern blimp. Reading further, Childress quotes from an ancient Indian text called the Samarangana Sutradhara. As quoted by Ivan T. Sanderson and Desmond Leslie, the following: strong and durable must the body be made, like a great flying bird or light material. Inside, one must place the mercury engine with its iron heating apparatus beneath. By means of the power latent in the mercury, which sets the driving whirlwind in motion, a man sitting inside may travel to great distance in the sky in a most marvelous manner. Similarly, by using the prescribed processes, one can build a vimana as large as the temple of the god in motion. Four strong mercury containers must be built into the interior structure. When these have been heated by controlled fire from iron containers, the vimana develops thunder power through the mercury, and at once it becomes a pearl in the sky. Moreover, if this iron engine with properly welded joints be filled with mercury and the fire be conducted in the upper part, it develops power with the roar of a lion. Now we call these mercury vortex engines. Childress further states the following: recently, Sanskrit documents discovered by the Chinese in Lhasa were sent to India to be studied by experts there. Dr. Ruth Renya, of the University of Chandigarh said that the manuscripts contain directions for building interplanetary spaceships. Indian scientists were at first extremely reserved about the value of these documents, but became less so when the Chinese announced that certain parts of the data were being studied for inclusion in their space program. These airships, perhaps powered by anti-gravity, as the document found by the Chinese suggests, are theoretically kept in secret bases. These airships, virtual UFOs, may actually be the cause of some UFO sightings, especially those in Central Asia. A single drop of mercury, excited with a jolt of electricity and held in that state with a smaller amount of electrical power, will form a plasma that emits ultraviolet energy, 254 nanometers in wavelength, and can generate chemical free radicals used in curing polymers or in sterilizing surfaces of all germs and viruses. The following is taken from Judd's Atlantis Mother of Empires. According to the records held by the Asiatic Society of Calcutta, India, of about 100 years ago, the ancient Hindu books frequently refer to the lost Atlantis as the White Island or the White Devil. In Volume 8 of the Asiatic Researches, page 286, we read, "This Atlantis was overwhelmed by a flood." Also in this remarkable collection of Hindu records, we learn that the early Egyptians conquered and ruled India. Continuing from the same book, Heinrich Schliemann, the discoverer of Troy and Mycenae in 1873, states, "There is a papyrus roll written in the reign of Pharaoh, relating how that monarch sent an expedition to the west in search of traces of the land of Atlantis, whence 3,350 years before the ancient ancestors of Egyptians arrived, carrying with them all the wisdom of their native land. Pharaoh sent, or Senta, lived in the Second Dynasty, or about 4100 BC, although he is mentioned in connection with a writing of the First Dynasty. This date, added to the 3350, places the date of the arrival of the ancestors King Sent refers to as 7450 BC. It is also interesting to note that the words Atlas and Atlantic have no satisfactory etymology in any language known to Europe. They are not Greek and cannot be referred to any known language of the Old World. The root of the words is not known. The Nephilim, having come from other dimensions, had much knowledge of the workings of the great universes. They understood the laws and physics of the temporal universe. Therefore, they were able to harness and utilize various types of forces and technology. When this is understood, then the idea of having airships, interplanetary spaceships, laser weapons, and transoceanic flights to different parts of the world many thousands of years ago certainly has more credence. Picture the Nephilim as the Darth Vaders of our universe, using Star Wars technology. Since their eviction from heaven, these spiritual beings, having been battling for control or dominion of space and planets in this universe to call home, it is the age-old story of the sons of darkness against the sons of light that has been immortalized in fables, myths, and even sacred scriptures. According to Plato, in 9600 BC, the remaining portion of Atlantis sunk into the ocean after another cataclysmic event. This would be the cataclysm that the authors Allen and Dallaire, in their book, When the Earth Nearly Died, state occurred in 9500 BC. Amazingly, these dates are separated by only 100 years. The following account is called the rattling of the Pleiades, which no doubt refers to the same cataclysm of 9600 or 9500 BC. The Chilam Balam of Chumayel speaks of an almighty cataclysm during which the great serpent was ravished from the heavens together with the rattles of its tail, so that its skin and pieces of its bones fell here upon the earth. The Kalina Carib tribe in Suriname, formerly Dutch Guiana, South America, still have myths of a fiery serpent that came from the Pleiades and brought the world to an end with a great fire and a deluge. The elder gods, having been forewarned, fled this planet and watched the destruction from afar. The Zohar states that they trembled with fear in the heavens as they witnessed the horrible sight. 90% of all life perished on this planet. We want to impress upon the reader that the great war that started in heaven, or the highest spiritual universe, continues on in the temporal universe. It is good battling against evil, and still is being played out on this planet and other worlds. Lucifer remains the source of most of the problems and evil that plague mankind. Most of us don't realize that we continue to pay tribute to these gods on a daily basis, and have been doing so for over 2,000 years. The very days of the week are named after them as follows. Monday is named after the moon goddess known as Selene, Luna, or Mani. Tuesday is named after the Roman god of war, Mars. Wednesday is named after the Roman messenger god, Mercury. Thursday is named after the Roman god of thunder, Jupiter. Friday is named after the Norse god, Odin's wife, the goddess Frigga. Saturday is named after the Roman god Saturn, and Sunday is named after the Roman god of the sun, Sol. The names of the 7 days of the week were adopted in Rome about 400 AD and spread into Europe, but were in use long before that in the East. The Hebrews refused to pay them tribute, preferring instead to simply call each day of the week by a number, Sunday being their first day of the week, etc. We pay tribute by naming some of the months of the year after them as follows. January was named after the god Janus, the Roman god of gates and doorways. March was named for the Roman god of war, known to the Greeks as Ares. April was named for the Roman goddess Venus, known to the Greeks as Aphrodite. May was named for the Italic goddess of spring, Maia. June was named for the goddess of marriage, Juno. She was the sister of the god Jupiter. One of the most sacred Christian holidays, Easter, is named after the ancient Olympian goddess of spring, Ishtar, or Eshtar, but known to the Romans as Venus, to the Greeks as Aphrodite, to the Akkadians and the Sumerians as Inanna. To the Babylonians, she was Astarte, the wife of Baal, the sun god. The word Easter was added to the New Testament in one of many translations and does not exist in the ancient texts. The symbols of rabbits, eggs, and the custom of hunting for hidden eggs are carryovers from the pagan rites of spring. Celebrating Christmas has been controversial since its inception. Any historian knows that taxes were rendered from the firstlings of the flock and field, and payment was due the empire in early spring. Jesus was born early in the fourth month of the year, not in December. The Romans celebrated Saturnalia, a festival dedicated to Saturn, the god of peace and plenty, in December. The council led by Constantine combined their Christmas holidays with the Roman holidays of Saturnalia as a master plan to more easily establish Christianity as the state religion among the heathen nations. From the festival of Saturnalia came the lights, merriment, feasting, frequent excesses, and gift-giving that we see today. This part of Christmas had its roots in pagan practices, honoring the god Saturn, who was one of the Titans, or Nephilim. The simplicity of the Nativity was meant to be a holy day without the contrast of merriment and excesses we see today. Another popular ritual is the burning of the Yule log, which is strongly embedded in the worship of the gods of vegetation and fire. The use of mistletoe and holly is associated with the god of fertility. Throughout the centuries and into the present, many people have condemned such practices as being pagan and contrary to the true spirit of Christmas. Modern efforts to commercialize the celebration for all holiday shoppers have nearly sterilized the season of any mention of Jesus. It culminates with Santa delivering toys to children, not with the birth of the Savior of mankind. 40% of all retail profits are realized between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Traditional American Thanksgiving tables often display a horn of plenty, sometimes woven like a basket. This horn, called a cornucopia, is actually a horned fertility symbol that was a tribute to Baphomet's fertility and symbolized Zeus being suckled by a goat whose horn broke off and was magically filled with fruit. Baphomet was a pagan fertility god associated with creative forces of reproduction and had the head of a goat. And if the above are not enough to satisfy our pagan appetites, even the planets in our solar system bear their names. We have associated them with our sun, moon, planet Earth, astrology, and even named some stars, satellites, and automobiles in their honor. Have we lost our minds, or what are we thinking? Of course, we have to mention the clairvoyant Edgar Cayce's prediction in 1940 when he said, "And Poseidia will be among the first portions of Atlantis to rise again. Expect it in 1968 or 1969, not so far away." He further predicted, "For these mountaintops, the Bimini Islands, especially that along the north and eastern shores of the north and northern portions of the South Island, will produce many various minerals and various other conditions that will be remunerative when the projects are undertaken." Explorations on Bimini during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s have produced inconclusive results. The famous Bimini Road site provided more questions than answers. These sites recently have had a renewed interest in exploration using high technology approaches to solve the mystery of Bimini and, with luck, rediscover Atlantis. Did the lost civilizations of Mu and Atlantis ever exist? If you had asked us that question 10 years ago, the answer would be probably not. Only a few historians or archaeologists even mentioned it before 1985 for fear of being cast out of the mainstream of their professions. After having completed a comprehensive compilation of data on the fallen angels from both ancient and historical worldwide perspectives, a different story began to emerge, one that we have tried to present in this book. Uncovering the fact that the Greeks also referred to the Titans as elder gods, Els, and Elanakim, short for elder race or simply the giants, was a major turning point that made us realize the Greeks knew this race of gods to be actual historical figures that once lived on the fabulous island of Atlantis and elsewhere in the world. Their myths and fables, we now believe, are based on actual historical events. In the past, stories of the giants were fragmented and the overall picture unclear. When we compiled and reconciled all our research data in a timeline format on the giants, it quickly became apparent that this was a major piece of the Earth's history that has not been accounted for, or at least taken seriously. If these civilizations once existed, then where is the evidence? The megalithic stone cities and giant stone structures found worldwide are part of the remaining evidence. The builders possessed technology that we today cannot duplicate, and yet various scientific groups persist in calling them a primitive Stone Age people. The remnants of the lost island, continent of Mu, as tradition persists among the Pacific Islanders of today, are the volcanic mountaintops in the South Pacific and possibly Australia. Although the ruins of Atlantis have not yet been located, the sudden and abrupt Western immigration patterns onto the European and African continents of an already civilized people with advanced technology strongly indicates Atlantis was the source. The cataclysm may have destroyed all traces of the island through tectonic plate upheavals and crust displacement. However, it appears that the myths and fables associated with the gods have actual historical basis. One more thought. The gaping hole left in the Earth's side after the cataclysm may have been the former site of Atlantis. If so, then the giant statue of Poseidon may be in orbit somewhere in outer space. Again, if you ask us this same question today, did the lost civilizations of Mu and Atlantis ever exist? The answer is yes. We believe that they most likely did. Still a skeptic? Read the next chapter.